Hello and welcome to Healing From Within. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, and am delighted to welcome for a second visit to our show, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, author of his newest fictional psychological thriller, Love Gone Mad, which is guaranteed to raise goosebumps, but also to show readers how our early life memories and insecurities influence our choices for good or bad as we mature and help us develop a greater wisdom of our motivations and a deeper view of what is really important in our lives. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Cheryl.
Welcome. Mark, you know, as listeners of Healing From Within know, the show explores our human responses and humane development for a more comprehensive view of our inner life or spiritual concerns and how the outside world contributes to our emotional state of being. The goal is always to learn more about ourselves, the human condition, and how to improve our health and joy in life. In today's show, Dr. Rubenstein, who is a physician, psychiatrist, and novelist who has written nonfiction medical advice books and is now focusing on mystery thrillers about people involved in life and death struggles with forces they cannot control, often driven by their pasts, will blend his understandings of the mind, body, and spirit not only to survive, but to thrive in the most challenging circumstances. He also blogs for the Huffington Post and is a contributor to Psychology Today. Mark, please give us a summary of the storyline. And is this story in some way like your last book, Mad Dog House, partly autobiographical?
No, thank God this is not autobiographical at all. Oh, boy, if it were, I wouldn't be here talking with you now. A brief summary is the following. Megan Haggerty is a lovely 30-something-year-old nurse who is divorced, a neonatal ICU nurse. And she meets in the hospital cafeteria a young, handsome surgeon named Adrian Douglas. It's a purely happenstance meeting. They have to have lunch at the same table. They strike up a conversation, and he, too, is divorced. And they each have a good deal of luggage from their past, or should I say baggage, excess baggage from their past.
They really do.
Oh, yeah, except that Megan's is quite a bit heavier, so to speak, than Adrian's in the form of an ex-husband living out in Colorado, or so it seems. But he is loaded with baggage, concerning obsessive jealousy and anger. And lo and behold, Adrian and Megan begin seeing each other romantically, and strange things begin to happen. The couple soon realizes that individually and together, they are being followed, and I guess the real operative word is stalked.
Yes, and the frightening word is stalked.
Yeah, they are being stalked, and it's not a question of who's stalking them. That becomes pretty clear early on in the novel, but the whys and the wherefores and all of the complications and permutations of this become more and more apparent, sort of like an onion skin unfolding as the novel progresses, and it turns into some life and death scenarios. And Cheryl, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but
no.
that's pretty much the...
It did keep me hanging to the very end.
Okay.
So I don't think we're going to be able to give too much away. But let's go on to what are some of the emotions and human themes that the main characters are exploring in the story, and how do they mature as a result of their experiences?
Well, you know, Megan was adopted basically at birth, so she was involved in the inevitable and really interminable quest concerning who am I, where do I come from, who are my parents, and the fact that her first husband was also adopted made for a powerful, compelling, almost kinetic kind of attraction for each other, and it was really the wrong reason for them to get together. Adrian, on the other hand, lost his father in a very traumatic way when Adrian himself was 6 years old. His father died suddenly of a heart attack while the family was in a restaurant. Adrian witnessed this at age 6, and it had profound effect on him. In fact, he became a heart surgeon. It was his wish, on some level, to undo or redo what the tragedy was that occurred to his father. So each of these people is operating out of a paradigm of the past, so to speak, in an attempt to either redo, refashion, or even perhaps psychologically undo early traumas from their past and meet somebody or do something that's going to make them feel more whole than they really did.
That's what I think one of the major themes are fear and love, which are indeed
fear
the
love,
two
yes.
major emotions that we all deal with every day, and everything else is only a variation of these. But the book also, as you said, explores adoption. It also explores childhood sexual abuse. It it talks about marriage and divorce
and
some
love,
of
and
yeah.
betrayal.
And betrayal. I wanted to use that word.
Many kinds of betrayals. Not,
loss
not
of
just,
trust. Yeah.
Yeah, trust and betrayal and loss of the ability to trust a partner or a spouse, not necessarily by virtue of sexual infidelity, but as you know, Cheryl, from having read the novel, there are other ways that a partner can betray a loved one.
And the book does show that.
And yes.
Now, it also shows unpleasant political work situations and how people deal with each other because they're in a competitive situation and they're not always using their most, the kindest and most loving way to work together. So that was another theme that I saw in the book. Now,
yes, it does. And it also points out the danger for some people of sexual allure and attraction in the workplace, and I'm not talking about sexual harassment, you know, the kind of things,
Yeah,
but how sexual allure can really sidestep a working relationship, and or I shouldn't say sidestep, it can really trip up a working relationship, and it can influence people in certain ways so that they end up making very bad decisions.
Absolutely, and I'm going to put a word in here. Unfortunately, sometimes we meet people who are manipulative and have their own agenda, and they are aware of the power they exert on other people, and they sometimes use it for their own gain. And I have, of course, seen that in many workplaces, so as I'm sure you have too. It is good for the readers to observe in your book how this happens and how dangerous it can be when it's out of control.
Yes, it's very dangerous. Manipulation by people, whether it's the kind of manipulation that's described in the book by one of the characters, a fellow named Conrad, or the kinds of manipulation that are done by one of the psychiatrists involved in the story. The book really bounces along at certain points with the legal system and the medical community and the psychiatric communities and how they all interface and interact with each other and how especially when it comes to courtroom scenarios, how attorneys try to manipulate things as well. And what we see is a potpourri of things that really can end up with tragic circumstances and very frightening ones.
That is true. Now, Mark, have you had any personal experience with adoption?
Not my, no, I fortunately
or anyone in your
adopted,
circle?
I guess someone in my family, a cousin of mine, was adopted, and I have one friend who was adopted, and it is amazing. In some respects, these two people are carbon copies of each other in terms of the interminable quest to find out about who their parents were. There is the sense that they
so that you saw that there was a psychological imprint on these children.
Oh, absolutely, and one that lasts throughout the rest of their lives. Let me give you just a little example. One of these people is a woman who has two young boys, and one of the boys was born with a defect in his eye. He's blind in one eye. It's a congenital kind of thing. And she began beating herself over the head, so to speak, emotionally, because she figured it was part of her own genetic makeup, which she didn't know. You know, who am I? Where do I come from? What is my genetic heritage? And what have I passed on to my child? So that's just one relatively small example of the kind of self-flagellation that can go on in this sort of situation. But, you know, there is an interminable quest that almost all people go through in terms of wanting to know, who am I? And where am I going? Where do I come from? And you know, if we're lucky, we knew our grandparents. Most of us don't know anyone beyond our grandparents. Once in a blue moon, some of us know who our great-grandparents were and may even have had contact with them, but that's very rare and unusual. And so there's always that sense of, you know, what's in my genetic code, emotionally, physically,
spiritually? Well, I think there's the greatest sense of loss at the soul level and sadness that they never knew why they were not accepted by their birth parents, and they carry that. Now, I interviewed Dr. Eben Alexander. He wrote a book, Proof of Heaven, and adoption was one of the big themes in his book. He was adopted by a very wonderful family, and he became a neurosurgeon like his adopted father, but he still described very in detail emotional language that made me cry, actually, how he experienced that loss. And so I'm glad you addressed it in your book, too.
It's a rejection. One who knows he or she has been adopted has a sense that my life began with my being given up, my being given away, rejected, put it however you will, but that becomes an indelible kind of scarring of sorts, and it's one that most people have a great deal of difficulty really overcoming. So.
I would agree with you. And then we have the stalker in the book. His name is Conrad Wilson. And, you know, he's described this way. I love it. He's not a very good person, you know, but it's not all his fault either. But he's described as intelligent, attractive, with sensory abilities that are almost primitive. And during the course of the story, it is revealed that he was traumatized as a child by an adopted father. And as a result, he is emotionally stunted and damaged. And that doesn't show up right away. And that's why this beautiful girl, Megan, married him. She couldn't see that damage. And you don't very often on very troubled souls. You don't see it.
She could not see what was lurking beneath the surface in Conrad. She was struck by his physicality, by his looks, by his physical strength, and by his seeming gentleness at the outset. But she, at some point, began to become aware of the terrible troubles that lurked not so deeply down there, especially when she had a baby. And there are many men who have difficulty dealing with sharing their wives with a newborn.
I once heard that from a friend of mine, and he said, well, she's so tuned into this child, there's just no room for me. And I had never heard it expressed exactly that way.
I guess
for a lot of men, that may be an issue. And women should be sensitive enough to observe and to have an authentic, loving relationship, to have enough energy and love for their children and their mate. That's you have to work at that. That's not something that comes easily.
Especially men have to work at it because, you know, I don't know if you'll agree with me, Cheryl, but as a man, I feel free to say this. Many men, not most, but many men are at heart little boys.
I might agree with that.
And they have trouble sharing the woman in their lives with anyone else. And that can even include a newborn baby, especially since at the very outset, at the beginning of a baby's life, most mothers are so tuned into the newborn, and the newborn is so demanding, and very often fathers, new fathers, feel in some way neglected and rejected.
And maybe they feel to blame for having gotten their wife pregnant in the first place, watching her go through the trauma of a pregnancy and a delivery. And maybe they even have a little guilt there that was a pretty rough thing. And I can see why she's standing at a distance from me now. And maybe I deserve that. Could be something as simple as that also. Although nothing is simple in human relationships and making things better. Right.
Nothing is ever simple. You hit the nail on the head. And if Conrad only knew a little bit more about the pregnancy, oh, my God, what might have happened then. But he did know.
Oh, he did know on a soul level, an instinctual level. He knew something. Yeah, that turned out to be actually true in the end, but he didn't know, on a practical level. He didn't have proof of it.
Oh, no, he had no proof, but I can tell you this, and it's not a spoiler at all, although I'm sure you're aware of this, having read the novel. In Love Gone Mad, in the very first chapter, Adrian, after a long, long day and into the night in the operating room, he goes to a nearby bar just to... just to calm down and have a beer, and a man starts an argument with him. It turns out, of course, to be Conrad, and there's something about Adrian that Conrad detects in his own very soulful, primitive way that emerges later in the book.
I'm going to say in his instinctual, primal, and intuitive way.
Absolutely.
That part of the brain that knows things that our conscious mind might not.
Or that our intellect are incapable of really incorporating. It comes from the midbrain, and it comes from the deepest elements of some people. I even, in an afterword, as I'm sure you're aware, I address the issue of what precisely is the soul, and what does this mean, I even talk about soul murder, and I didn't know this until I happened to look it up, but soul murder was used by Ibsen. It was the first use of the term soul murder, and it refers to the parent who is, in his or her own way, beats out and snuffs out the capacity for joy in a child when the child is young. And that's partly what happened to Conrad for a variety of reasons, but also the whole issue of the soul and of love and of the novel begins with the issues having to do with primitive sensory and other kinds of feelers, and ends on words concerning love.
Yes, and I'm going to go on to the next question with that. Love Gone Mad is a well-written and engaging story, but beneath the story lie the vision I believe you wish to share of what you have learned in your professional life as a psychiatrist and the values you at this stage of your life hold dear. Please, Mark, tell us about this. And you were just doing it.
Yes, love is, Freud was once asked, what makes for a well-adjusted person, a human being who really can at least achieve contentedness in the world? And Freud, in his inimitable way, said, well, the ability to love and to work. In a simple way, I mean, he really summed it up. But, what I was, and the title of the novel is Love Gone Mad, and I'm giving a talk this Friday at a local Rotary Club called Love and Obsession, The Thin Line Between Love and Madness. And that's certainly not my take on love, but, as a psychiatrist for many years, I have seen, if you ever see two people divorcing, we're going through
it can get pretty ugly.
Oh, you wonder, were these two people ever in love? I mean, they had children together, they lived together, they made a life together, and the hatred that can...
Well,
so that
Mark, there is a duality to everything in life. There is the good, the bad, and what lies in between. And it's all very natural. But our goal should be to find our balance and to walk perhaps one foot in spirit and one foot on the earth, and then know that we're very magnificent beings who have a great deal of potential, but if we don't focus on developing ourselves totally, and we don't help the children that we say we love to do the same thing, we all limited them, and we're causing what you just said, soul death. And I see too much of that right now going on with people and their materialistic ways. I'm not saying we're not pursuits, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we should not have a good, wonderful life and utilize everything around us in our physical life, but not to the exclusion of some very important values. Now, you wrote, we worry about humanity, and only kindness and love can bring us to a higher level of consciousness and functioning in both our physical and spiritual life. So, family, love interacting with children, pride in one's work. You just said how Freud said work was an important element to being balanced. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And staying fit, as you mentioned a great deal about the appearance of the characters in your book and how they are physically fit. But these are all important elements for our mental and physical well-being. And I think your book shows all that.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more with you, Cheryl. I think these are the important things in anyone's life. You know, the advantage of getting older, there are very few, but one of the advantages of getting older is the obtaining of some degree of wisdom. And, you know, the old story, I wish I knew then what I know now. I mean, as I get older, I am more and more aware of the things that really matter and count. This sounds so trite, but it's so
it's
true.
It's really not.
It isn't.
Never discover it.
It seems to me it took me forever to discover this, but this is the way I look at things now, and I wish I knew then what I know now. But then again, I wouldn't have been the young, you know, maniacal guy I was years ago, and I wouldn't have had half the experiences I had. Who knows? I might not even have gone into psychiatry. Or begun writing novels.
You know,
you never know.
There's no failure. And everything that's, I believe, that life is no coincidence, that's my first book, that we have a connection to this time and place, to other times and places, and nothing that happens to us is random. There is a pattern. There is a focus to bring us forward through all our experiences. So why try to judge them? They don't really have to be judged. They just have to be experience where they're hard, we need to find a way to make them easier, and where they're joyful, we need to find a way to be part of that energy and enjoy it. Now, Mark, as I discovered in your last book, the places you describe where the story is taking place are my familiar landmarks. I have a great deal of synchronicity. So I'd like to read to the audience, may I, something that you wrote?
Sure.
You write, Adrian realizes that the get-together at Aaron and Bob's house reminds him of his own Sunday afternoon dinners at his aunt's house in Hempstead, Long Island. He has hazy memories of Dad driving from their modest attached house in Ozone Park, Queens, taking the Cross Island Parkway to the Southern State Parkway, and then heading east to the Hempstead exit. A boisterous throng of aunts, uncles, and cousins gathered around a large table. Mark, you go on to say, you recall the laughter and the feelings of those days. You were part of a family. And Mark, this sounds and feels like my early childhood days and my family. So I'm going to go on to say, I imagine memories of safety and love sustain a person through the difficulties they may face later on in life. I'm grateful to have had that support from my immediate and extended family, and I think you are too, because you couldn't have said it any better than you said
Absolutely. Well, there's one point where Adrian's talking to his mom on the telephone. She is a widow living in Florida, in Pompano Beach, and while they're talking, he hears the cuckoo clock in the kitchen while she's on the phone, in her kitchen, and it evokes in him instantly the memory of the cuckoo clock in their home in Queens, but now it's a Florida cuckoo.
But a cuckoo clock nonetheless. So, Mark, let's go on, because I see a major new trend in Love Gone Mad, and it is, for me, quite different from the action in the book we discussed a year ago, Mad Dog House. This book, Love Gone Mad, focuses on compassion and family, love, personal change, and acceptance, because the main character, Dr. Adrian Douglas, is able to release anger in dealing with his emotions and eventually not kill the stalker who is trying to murder him. And he has a moment when he thinks about it. Tell us how you think the main character is able to handle his own anger and fear and revulsion after a vicious attack by a psychopath, so to put it.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't really know if I can encapsulate that in a couple of words. You know, Adrian was in the middle of this adrenalized fight for his life in a graveyard in the middle of the night somewhere in this isolated in the hills, in the Connecticut foothills, and he has a choice to make. It's a moral choice. And every book I write always involves some moral decision, some fork in the road. He momentarily thinks that I'm a surgeon, I'm a physician, above all, do no harm. On the other hand, he thinks of venomously of what Conrad has done to him and Megan. And I don't want to give anything away, but he has to make a decision. And whether the intellect, the compassion, the morality will prevail, or whether his own more base animal instinctual drives will take over and lead him to do what he knows he can get away with doing. It could even be construed as self-defense. And he has to make this decision. And I tried to put myself in that almost untenable position. And I've had friends say to me, well, if it was me, I'd have done it. Oh, well, no, I wouldn't have done it. And they go back and forth, and you really learn a little bit more about people and what they're made of in terms of what they would have done in the same situation. So what can I say? I'm not sure I can even answer the question, because only in extremis can you know how far you'll go.
I want to say, in conclusion and in reference to the title Love Gone Mad, is love indeed a state of madness or something else perhaps?
It's a lot of things. That's one of the questions that one of the characters asks at the end of the novel. You know, we're all familiar with statements such as, oh, I'm crazy about you, or I'm, well, wasn't there a great, comedy series, Mad About You, I'm mad for her, or, you know, he drives me crazy, or whatever. These are difficult. There are some people who do believe that love is a state of mind in which you do give up the capacity to see the other person and experience that person realistically. I say it's a good thing.
I think it might have many aspects to it. And yes, sometimes because of fear, we are wounded. And so the love is not always seen.
Yes.
Right? So that is why love is so challenging. But
it's
now,
challenging, it's delicious, it's lovely,
it's all
lightning.
It's what
that's
life
all
is supposed to be about, ultimately.
Right.
Now to love, and that is the question, and also for me, the answer to everything meaningful in life. Mark, you're right, and I wholeheartedly resonate in this knowing view. So what if love is a form of madness? That's just the way it is. I'm lucky
Absolutely.
To love and be loved. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And what could be more true? It's simple,
absolutely.
But it is the truth. So I want to thank you, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, for sharing the excitement of this psychological thriller, Love Gone Mad, and for sharing how in the life and death struggles your characters face, as indeed we all face one way or another, we can discover the joys and means to transcend evil, sickness, and to rise to a state of love. To purchase Love Gone Mad, which I enjoyed thoroughly, go to markrubensteinauthor.com. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, Dr. Rubenstein and I have shared, through medical and legal searches, the ways people may have been wounded and damaged early on in life. These conditions include poor parenting, early trauma, and life without true connections to family, friends, and a support team of concerned and conscious citizens. In the end, what it is that every soul craves and searches for is only love of self, kindness, and trust for a world of people that should offer beauty, peace, harmony, and balance. And that can feed our physical and spiritual needs. Parents, teachers, medical and legal institutions must reevaluate the values of what constitutes a good life and also a life well lived, and begin the road past the ordinary trials of daily life to experience higher consciousness through combining spirituality, science, and religion for a more comprehensive way to improve ourselves and the world community. I am Cheryl Glick, host of Healing From Within, and invite you to my website, CherylGlick.com, to hear the views and visions of extraordinary authors who offer their personal journeys through the challenges of the inner and outer world to find ways to empower our lives with health and prosperity. Shows are also available on WebTalkRadio.net and DreamVision7Radio.com. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Cheryl. It was a great interview.